This is an ABC podcast.
Hi, I'm Linda Mottram. In this episode, a New South Wales coroner wants to see pill testing in action at a weekend music festival. Major brands are still struggling to promise that their goods are not made using slave labour. And why is weight discrimination one of the last socially accepted stigmas? But first tonight, the ABC has revealed this evening that the Australian Federal Police wanted to fingerprint the journalists who investigated the activities of Australian Special Forces in Afghanistan for the story known as the Afghan Files. That's on top of the AFP's efforts seeking documents and travel records relating to the story. It's all fueling a furious backlash about press freedom, domestically and internationally. The ABC's head of investigative journalism, John Lyons, says the AFP requested the prints, including the palm prints of journalists Dan Oakes and Sam Clark, 2 months before the Federal Police raid on the ABC's headquarters early last month. He says it's chilling, a case of treating journalists as criminals for doing the work of public interest journalism. Our reporter Samantha Donovan has been following the story. Samantha, when did the AFP make this request and what form did it take?
Well, Linda, John Lyons has revealed the request was received in letters sent by email to the two journalists who worked on the Afghan Files story. That story went to air in 2017. The emailed letters were received by the pair on April Fool's Day, so April the 1st this year, but it was certainly no joke. That request, Linda, came just over 2 months before the AFP raided the ABC's Sydney headquarters and seized documents relating to that story. And John Lyons has this afternoon raised a question he'd like to put to the Home Affairs Minister, Peter Dutton. He's asking why, in that week of the raids on the ABC, was there 4 days of frenzied activity, as he calls it. He says that on the Monday of that week, the AFP wanted Ben Fordham from Sydney radio station 2GB to reveal the source of a story. He refused. The next morning, the AFP raided the Canberra home of News Corp journalist Annika Smith. The next day, there was the raid on the ABC, and Mr. Lyons says today he's revealing today that the AFP wanted to raid the Sydney headquarters of News Corp the following day, but that was cancelled. So Mr. Lyons is saying he'd like to know what prompted those attacks on the media that week. And aside from the raids, Linda, as we've heard, the AFP asked Qantas for Dan Oakes' travel records, and we understand that the airline did comply with that request.
And what were the offences being alleged that the AFP said required the reporter's fingerprints?
The letters, I understand, Linda, sent to Oakes and Clark referred to the pair being suspects in relation to 3 alleged offences. One under the Federal Crimes Act of 1914 concerning the receipt of prescribed information. One under the Defence Act of 1903 concerning unlawfully obtaining information. And another under a section of the Criminal Code relating to receiving stolen property.
And how has John Lyons, the ABC's head of investigative, characterised this move? Because there have been conflicting messages from the federal government on what the intent might be.
Yes, well, John Lyons says the journalists are being treated like criminals and being asked for their fingerprints, just like someone suspected of burgling a house. And he says the request for prints sits at odds with recent statements of the Federal Attorney General, Christian Porter. You may recall that he originally said there was no suggestion journalists were the targets of the raids, though Mr. Porter later retreated from that position, saying he didn't have all the information to hand when he said that. He's also said he'd be seriously disinclined to prosecute journalists, except in the most exceptional of circumstances. Whereas Mr. Porter's cabinet colleague, the Home Affairs Minister Peter Dutton, hasn't ruled out prosecuting journalists, saying reporters who receive top secret documents are committing a crime. John Lyons says the AFP request proves that the journalists Oakes and Clark are suspects and at risk of prosecution. He's told the ABC's news channel it's believed to be the first time Australian journalists have been asked for their fingerprints.
I think there's a fascinating political game going on at the moment in Canberra. The highest law officer in the country, the Attorney General Christian Porter, has said he was disinclined that journalists should be prosecuted. He has now softened and retreated from that position and said, I didn't know all the facts when I said that. Peter Dutton on Friday reaffirmed that journalists could well be prosecuted. He says that nobody's above the law, which of course is true. But what we're talking about here is that the way journalists are being treated, demands for fingerprints, travel records, in my view, it's moving down the course of criminalising legitimate investigative journalism.
The ABC's head of investigative journalism, John Lyons. Samantha, we've heard from media organisations and journalists here and from around the world, indeed, Britain, Canada, Germany, the US, plenty of warnings that this is an attack on press freedom in this country.
Yes, and this revelation that the AFP has asked for the fingerprints of the two ABC journalists will give weight to the arguments of those critics around the world who've been condemning the AFP for pursuing journalists in this way. Just last week, we heard human rights lawyer Amal Clooney suggest that Australia's stance could encourage oppressive regimes to crack down further on the press and possibly be used as an excuse to clamp down on journalists. She was speaking in her new role as Britain's envoy, special envoy on media freedom. She said the raids on the ABC showed that the weakening of press freedom isn't just limited to countries that aren't democracies. And she made those comments at an event in London attended by Australia's Foreign Minister, Maurice Payne. Ms Payne gave a short address to that conference. She didn't mention the ABC raids, but spoke of the need to find a sensible balance between protecting the national interest in the face of security threats, as well as upholding the public's right to know. Linda, the Home Affairs Minister Peter Dutton and the Attorney General Christian Porter have declined to respond to the revelation of the fingerprint request made of Dan Oakes and Sam Clark this evening to PM. The AFP has told us it's not appropriate for it to comment on an ongoing investigation. And the Federal Opposition, Linda, is calling on the Attorney General to confirm that he won't prosecute any Australian journalist.
Okay, thanks very much, Samantha Donovan, our reporter in Melbourne. Well, a New South Wales coroner investigating the deaths of six young people at music festivals has expressed interest in seeing pill testing in action at one of Australia's largest music festivals. The festival is Splendour in the Grass and it's on this weekend at Byron Bay, but organisers say they can't do that without government approval. Instead, a pill testing demonstration is on the cards. Our reporter Bronwyn Herbert joins me. Bronwyn, what's prompted the coroner to want to see pill testing in action?
Oh, hi, Linda. Look, the Deputy State Coroner, Harriet Green, is investigating a string of drug-related deaths at festivals in the state of New South Wales over the past couple of summers, and that had prompted a crackdown from the state government. Now, so broadly, she's been looking at each of those individual deaths and late last week looked into the prospect of pill testing and where that fits in the mechanics of trying to, you know, see whether that could help prevent deaths at festivals. And an emergency medicine specialist, David Caldicott, he was there and provided some evidence and explanation on why he believed it could help people use fewer drugs at festivals and therefore reduce deaths. And he says that the deputy coroner flagged her interest in seeing testing in action at Splendour in the Grass this weekend.
Well, I think she's most interested in looking at the mechanism by which we provide our pill testing. There's lots of different ways of doing it, Joe. For example, there are some people at the moment arguing that we should be just testing the contents of amnesty bins at the door of festivals. The way we do it is we couple the analytical results to a pretty intensive, short education for the consumer and some advice about how they can avoid being harmed. And we think that is the way to approach it. So we're very hopeful that we'll be allowed to show her that mechanism so that she can make some consideration on perhaps any recommendations that she would make going forward.
Dr. David Caldicott, who's an emergency medicine specialist. So, Bronwyn, what's been the response of festival organisers to this request?
Well, the organisers of Splendour in the Grass say pill testing as it currently stands remains illegal in New South Wales. So they can't, despite if, even if the coroner would like it to be there, they can't just perform it as such. So what they can do, however, there is the option of a demonstration of pill testing. And Dr. Caldicott, who will be at Splendour in a capacity of actually partaking in a science tent presentation, can provide a demonstration using a legal substance like Panadol or a paracetamol or the like. But it just has to be clearly defined as being a demonstration and not a pill testing trial as such. So they're definitely supporters of it, but at this stage it can't happen.
And any response yet from the New South Wales government on this?
Look, their response is that they won't be making any comments while the inquest is underway and that their position on pill testing hasn't yet changed, Linda.
Okay, Bronwyn Herbert, our reporter there. You're listening to PM on the radio, on the ABC Listen app and via the podcast. I'm Linda Mottram. On Twitter, I'm at Linda Mottram. Ahead, how a call out for genetic samples from Indigenous Australians in the 1990s inadvertently led to a big gap in medical research databases.
Potentially, that project put genetic science back 10 years. I don't think Aboriginal people were ready to even talk about DNA and genetics and all those sorts of things for a really long time.
Australian companies are facing criticism for failing to be active enough in making sure that their products are not made using slave labour. Several Australian companies, including Cotton On and Target Australia, have told tonight's Four Corners program they're investigating cotton suppliers they use in China's Xinjiang province for the possibility that Uyghur people working against their will are the source of the product. Up to 1 million, mostly Muslim Uyghurs, are reportedly part of a massive network of Chinese government re-education camps in Xinjiang province. Australia has new anti-slavery laws requiring most companies to report on the issue, but there are no penalties and no independent oversight. Professor Justine Nolan from the University of New South Wales Law School is the co-author of a forthcoming book addressing modern slavery, and she told me companies are still too reactive on the issue.
What we're seeing, Australian companies and companies around the world, that we see a bad story, we see, you know, stories of people being trapped in forced labour, and then companies are starting to say we need to look into this. There's now estimated to be more than 40 million people around the world enslaved, and 16 million of those are working for the private economy. So they're working as forced labourers for companies, for the goods that we use. And so companies don't have the luxury of just sitting back now and waiting to react.
And in the case of Xinjiang, should those companies have known? Should the idea that you're getting products from Xinjiang, given the headlines we've seen in recent times, should that have rung a bell earlier?
Yeah, I mean, what they've got to be looking for is where there are risks. And so companies are used to identifying risks in many things that they do. When you've got a province like that that is known to have forced labour camps, and if you're sourcing goods from that product, if you, you know, from that area, then you know that's a risk that you should be looking into very deeply.
And when you say companies are used to establishing risk in other areas, is there a sort of a directly transferable set of skills in a business, if you like, around risk analysis that can help to solve this issue of slavery?
No, I mean, it is a different skill, and we're asking companies definitely to skill up in this area, and it's not something companies should be doing alone. They need to be talking to unions, they need to be talking to workers, they need to be talking to NGOs, because they don't really have, you know, these social audit skills. But they can't be, you know, you can't be satisfied in them just sort of investigating internally and moving on.
And so can you talk a little bit more about those social audit skills? What does that mean exactly?
So what we're asking companies to do now that there's greater awareness around the conditions that goods are being produced, is to identify where there are risks of modern slavery. And so that might be workers working against their will. It might be looking at, what is your worker population? Do you have a lot of seasonal workers? Are there migrant workers? These workers inherently tend to be more vulnerable. Do you know how your workers were recruited into the workplace? Were they deceptively recruited? Did they pay a recruitment fee, which is illegal? All of these types of things we need to be knowing about the workforce to start to identify risk.
And that's very complex, isn't it? Because we're talking about supply chains that are global and very complex these days, like an iPhone, for example, must be an extraordinarily complex supply chain.
Yeah, so if you look at an iPhone, it would have about over 700 components that go into it within that supply chain. So what you're trying to do in many ways is track traceability. But if you think about something, so a few years ago, Samsung had the fires, the phones were going on fire. Within months, Samsung had identified the problem and stopped production. Yet we know that in electronics, in consumer goods, in cotton or whatever it is, that there is forced labor in these supply chains. And companies are still continuing to produce in risky regions. And so they're not applying those sort of tactics that they would otherwise to this area of their production.
And apart from risky regions, low wage regions, I suppose, what other practices might businesses be engaging in that can inadvertently perhaps contribute to a higher risk of slavery? I mean, I'm thinking, I guess, of tight schedules might be one of those factors, perhaps.
Yeah, so one of the real problems of modern slavery in supply chains is the business model itself. So, and part of this is the business, and part of it is also the demands from consumers, where we want things immediately. We want tight turnaround. So what you're seeing in supply chains is business imposing models that work all the way down that supply chain where the worker is crunched at the bottom. So there might be a very fast turnaround. It might be a forced overtime is required. They might change their mind at the last minute. So what happens in that supply chain is that it's subcontracted out. And so why a company may have agreed with a particular factory to produce something, when they change that order, some of that work will be subcontracted out to places that are not regulated. And then you're going to have problems with that supply chain.
Professor Justine Nolan, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.
Justine Nolan from the University of New South Wales Law School, speaking to me from Geneva. How does Australia make the most of being the meat in the US-China sandwich? It's becoming increasingly vexed. Just today, for example, it's reported that the chief of the Australian Defence Force, Angus Campbell, told a recent gathering that China could take advantage of Pacific Islands if climate change leads them to be abandoned. Responding this morning, Foreign Minister Maurice Payne had to walk a very fine line over where Australia's interests lie there. Well, how to navigate relationships without picking a side is becoming one of the big issues for Australia. And today, at a workshop between young business leaders and US consulate officials in Perth, that's exactly what was under discussion. Bridget Fitzgerald went along for PM.
I think that you hear people express both hope and concern.
Justin, by the way, is the acting US Consul General in Perth. He spoke to young professionals at the Perth US Asia Centre at the University of Western Australia today. He wants them to understand the long history of the US-Australian alliance.
There's challenges in a regional perspective in the Indo-Pacific. There's challenges to how do you get young people who don't maybe have the history of the US-Australia alliance and teach them about it and help them to understand why it matters that we're friends and why it matters that we want to continue to be friends moving forward, that we have those shared values.
Mounting US trade pressure has seen China's economic growth slow to its weakest pace in 27 years, prompting fears the dispute could lead to a global recession. And in the Asia Pacific, Australia is caught up in a geopolitical rift between the two superpowers. Torn between its alliance with its number one security and investment partner, the US, and its number one trade partner, China, as both compete for influence.
The Australians don't want to upset the Chinese because of the economic links, but they also don't want to upset the Americans because of the strategic importance.
David Denemark is an adjunct professor of political science at the University of Western Australia. And to him, being stuck in the middle can be an advantage.
Oz is either the meat in the sandwich and caught in a kind of invidious position between two major superpowers who are increasingly at each other's throats, or it gives them strategic leverage, which is exactly what you kind of want. If you don't have the absolute military power, but you, because of your links with the United States, able to punch above your weight.
We have to try and work as seriously as we can with the Chinese and the Americans to ensure that we craft the best outcome for our country and for our region for peace and stability and security.
Senior fellow with the Perth US Asia Centre and Pro Vice Chancellor of Education at the University of Western Australia, Peter Dean. He says there's a delicate balance, but Australia is in a position to benefit from both alliances.
We have to be agile and we have to be very sure about what our own strategic interests are and what our own economic interests are and how we balance those between our number one investing country and our number one security partner in the United States, of which we have a very long-term and deep engagement with, and of course a very important country like China.
Among the students and young professionals taking part at today's workshop, China is central to any discussion about the Australian-US alliance.
We don't want to be the piggy in the middle and inadvertently or unwittingly put either China or the US offside, so learning how to manage the relationship.
Lisa Markison works in the Office of the Attorney General of Western Australia.
There's something to be said, and there can be, you know, something quite powerful in being the middle player and in being able to sort of go between and sort of assist our Pacific neighbours where we need to and sort of be a softer form of influence where the US can sometimes be a little bit overarching and intimidating.
And Master of Economics student at the University of Western Australia, Danielle Lorick, agrees.
If, say, the US started treating us more poorly, we could start cozying up to China and use that as leverage. It's a much better situation than being only friends with one.
Master of Economics student Danielle Lorick. Bridget Fitzgerald, our reporter in Perth. Australia's biobanks, repositories of a huge variety of genetic samples for medical research, are lacking in genetic diversity, with researchers saying Indigenous Australians are drastically underrepresented. Gene research is at the forefront of medical breakthroughs, and the researchers say that biobanks and research centres must become more inclusive. Sarah Collard reports.
DNA and genetics is a complex business, with doctors and researchers still trying to unlock the secrets to improve our health. Deakin University's Dr. Emma Cavall says biobanks, which can hold the genetic material from thousands of individuals, are an increasingly vital tool to help understand complex diseases and health issues.
As we're moving into the world of precision medicine, where we're learning more and more about genomics and seeing how it can impact on and improve healthcare, biobanks are becoming more and more important.
Researchers surveyed 16 biobanks across Australia and found many were lacking samples from Indigenous people or were unsure.
The information that we can get from biobank research is really limited to the kinds of people who donate samples. So if people who are involved in biobanks are only from one part of the population, then those people are going to be the ones who can benefit the most.
Almost 70% of biobanks reported up to 1% of participants were Indigenous, but Dr. Cavall says research could be used to improve Indigenous health.
In particular areas of Aboriginal health, it is clear that genomics can play a role, and we've seen that in, for example, rare cancers, rheumatic heart disease. There are diseases that are specific or seen in much higher rates in Aboriginal communities where genomics can play a role.
She says Australian biobanks aren't subject to the rules followed in other countries.
In Australia, we are not seeing that at all. And this research that we've done looking at Australian biobanks shows that biobanks are really not aware of how to include Indigenous people and don't have any policies or practices to do so.
Gamoy Walbury Yidinji woman, Azur Hermes, is at the National Indigenous Genomics Centre. She says Indigenous Australians have had a fraught history with researchers. In the 1990s, an international scientific effort, known as the Human Genome Project, endeavoured to sequence the DNA of humans, including Indigenous peoples. But it was dubbed the Vampire Project in some Indigenous communities.
It was in a time where Aboriginal people were standing up and saying, actually, this is not okay, and we don't want you to do this. You need to come and talk to us about this. And potentially, that project put genetic science back 10 years. I don't think Aboriginal people were ready to even talk about DNA and genetics and all those sorts of things for a really long time.
Ms. Hermes says building trust with Indigenous communities is key, and that takes time and work.
I think they need to invest more time in communities. Communities want to be a part of research. They just also want to be a part of the decision-making process of it. And so that might mean that researchers need to have good, honest discussions about what to expect from their research project, the pros and cons of being a part of this project.
The University of Sydney's Dr. Christine Barlow-Stewart is the former head of the Centre for Genetics Education. She's calling for greater regulation of biobanks.
I think that we really need to ensure that biobank samples are representative of our Australian community. And that means placing increasing regulation to ensure that there are requirements to ensure that it is representative.
Dr. Emma Cavall says now is the time to ensure biobanks reach out to diverse communities, building up relationships and knowledge.
It's a really great opportunity to make it better and to make it more responsive to all Australians, Indigenous people, and all Australians who might not be so well served by the mainstream systems that we have.
Deakin University's Dr. Emma Cavall, Sarah Collard, our reporter. 2 out of 3 Australians are now overweight or obese, and health experts warn that's putting a big strain on our health system. But weight is also a social minefield. If you don't fit someone else's idea of what the right weight is, you may find yourself being shamed. Those on the receiving end of that kind of discrimination believe it's one of the last socially acceptable stigmas, and it risks confusing the health messages. Sarah White reports.
I feel that people are always looking at me, judging me. I tend to wear extremely baggy clothes wherever I go because I'm just so self-conscious.
This is Sam, a 27-year-old woman who lives in Bendigo in Victoria, who's been the victim of fat shaming.
I've had people come up to me and say that I shouldn't wear certain clothes.
Like what would you be wearing?
I'd just be wearing a pair of jeans and a t-shirt. I'm a size 14. And I've had 2 kids, so, you know, I've got the love handles and the mum tum going on.
And so are these total strangers? You've never met them before?
Never met them before. I was in Big W when someone said it to me, trying to buy some new clothes for my daughter. And someone came up to me and said I should wear for my size.
And how did you respond?
I was a bit taken aback. Normally I'm really quick-witted, but I kind of just stood there shocked and they walked off. I don't even think my husband knew what to say. Even he was taken aback.
Sam, who asked us not to use her real name, is among 2/3 of Australians who are considered to be overweight or obese. Dr. Joseph Proietto is a professor at the University of Melbourne. He says weight discrimination is one of the last socially acceptable stigmas.
There's good evidence for discrimination against people with obesity in all areas of society, including, unfortunately, the medical profession.
Is this becoming more common?
As obesity became more prevalent, stigma became more common, yes.
Professor Proietto says what's needed is more education so people understand the difference between what is a healthy weight and what is not.
The best way to fix discrimination is to inform the public that obesity has a very strong genetic or epigenetic basis. And once people understand that it's not just people deciding to eat more, that it's more than that, then hopefully the bias will diminish.
Dr. Nick Fuller works at the Charles Perkins Centre at the University of Sydney. The centre sees thousands of patients a year who want to lose weight, and they all have stories of discrimination.
Yeah, discrimination's becoming definitely more prevalent.
But Dr. Fuller says for those who are trying to lose weight, it can be hard when confronted with cheap and convenient fast food options.
We are bombarded with, you know, diets and buzzwords and new pills and specially marketed foods every day of the week that all promise, you know, that magic bullet that we're looking for. But there is none and there never will be because obesity is a serious problem and it's a disease. And that, what I mean by that is your body will always fight the weight loss. We have this set point or this body weight that we're very comfortable being at, and it's that weight you'll remember being at for a long period of time. So when you actually lose a little bit of weight, you go on a weight loss program or a diet, of course you can lose weight. But then what will happen is your body will fight that weight loss.
Australia is now ranked in the top 5 countries for its obesity rate behind the US, Mexico, New Zealand and Hungary. And experts like Professor Gary Sachs from the Global Obesity Centre at Deakin University says obesity in Australia is such a health crisis that it can't be ignored.
The latest evidence estimates that obesity is costing Australia about $10 billion each year. That's in healthcare costs and lost productivity because of obesity. And so as a community, we need to wake up to this problem. Addressing it will be really cost-effective for Australia.
But for people like Sam, she just wants to be able to exercise without people making comments to her.
Now, most times when I go out, I wear tracksuits and baggy clothes because I feel so self-conscious and I don't want people coming up to me and saying these things to me. I think having the normality at, say, size 12 to size 14, which is what majority of the people I know are, I think that will help curb the stigma.
Sam from Bendigo speaking with Sarah White. I'm Linda Mottram and that is PM. Find us on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts, and don't forget to subscribe and leave us a review. Until next time.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.